So, it's the first Radio Salon of Moving in November Festival 2019. And from Esitys Radio, we have Mira and
Anna.
And we are joined by two of the artists whose work we've seen at the festival so far. Unfortunately, Theo and Stephen couldn't join us today, but we have Elena and Mart. Could you please also introduce yourselves and... Yes, just introduce yourself for now.
Well, I'm a performance artist based in Tallinn, not so far from here, for being active in the scene for quite a long. And I would say that's pretty much it. Have a dance background, but done a little bit of everything, as we all, I guess.
My name is Eleanor Bauer. I'm from the States originally. Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I've been in Brussels for 13 years and just recently relocated or moved to Stockholm in 2017 to start the PhD in choreography at Stockholm University of the Arts. So Stockholm is my new base. I'm a dancer, choreographer, I make stuff on stages, and a total show pony. For hire,
anything for money.
Exactly. Also, just to say to the listeners that we also have an audience here, so you might hear also other people present in the space.
I'll be working for their laughter.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. To start with, I would like to ask you both to describe your performance to a listener who maybe didn't see it yet, at least.
Martin. Shall I start?
Yeah. Oh, well. You're fresh.
You just
had your performance, literally.
Which I actually don't remember anything of. It's a solo performance. I'm on stage. I kind of made it in collaboration with actually quite a few people. Kalle Dikas was helping me with technical solutions. Anu Wachtra, a visual artist, was helping me with the space. And Eero Epner, who is the dramaturg, former dramaturg of No99 and good colleague of mine, helped me with the text and dramaturgy of it. But it's basically a piece about remembering. What do we remember? How do we remember? What do we choose to remember and what we choose to forget? But it's not really research or anything, it's more like poetical journey throughout personal and public, milestones which one picks to wrap one's identity around. And it's after a long time I had made a solo. So I was working really with text and the theater for quite many years in between, and then somehow I wanted to return to my own stuff, doing things alone, even though we know in theater we never do it alone, but so this maybe is like in general it.
Could you describe a bit of what someone witnessing or experiencing it might encounter, or what they see?
Oh, then now I go into a very long monologue, maybe. But what interests me, or what I want to offer, is really what is happening. This kind of a contrast of one, the topic, remembering, deals with past. But actually, I'm interested in the present. What is going on in the present? And this is actually what I'm trying to offer. By presenting the past, I'm presenting actually the present and the sensation of it. What is going on there in among us, who in the space, all who are there, the audience, so I wouldn't even say the stage, but in the space. And there are kind of poetic stories unfolding, sometimes banal, sometimes more romantic, but really I'm dealing with that moment of being together. It's now sounds a bit pathetic when I say it. But yeah, so this is maybe what one experiences, oh, it's so hard, I never had to do it, is yeah, kind of being there and connecting through the way how I perform and how I kind of intertwine all these little, well, how to say it in English, knit those networks between us, who we are there in the space. Amen.
Great, thank you.
Well, that was too much.
I presented a work called A Lot of Moving Parts, which is different all the time. It is literally and figuratively a lot of moving parts. And in this iteration, it was the first time that I worked with a group of people. So I wasn't alone on stage with the research. And the research is on the relationship between dancing and writing. So a lot of it is about searching for adequate language to meet the felt sense that dance makes. In this iteration of the work, we worked really with sci-fi as a genre that is somehow related to how dance thinks for me, because dance is so psychedelic. No, when dancing, there's the felt sense that I'm making in movement and with all of my sensations can have a very rich and generative imaginarium. That's kind of a practice of world-making. So we really emphasized that in the process and did a lot of writing from our own experiences, being moved by others or sharing a dance practice and then writing as if our bind, I don't say body or mind, our binds, our Mahdi binds, are like worlds or subjects or beings that could have permission not to be, as we've all agreed, maybe a human form is ergonomically or functionally operative, whatever. So really going, leaning into the hallucinatory potentials of moving and being moved. So what happens, audience enters, there's this soft curtain fluff over the ceiling that's lit, you know, and makes kind of a cloudy, just really fabric, but you know, aiming for clouds. Gray floor, a bunch of dance, like seven dancers. Almost everybody has some velvet on, so texture is important. Right away, you get texture is important. Should be touchy feely. And we're dancing around, it's a groovy, noodly, noodly improvising, and then we go up to audience members and whisper little poems from our spontaneous dance experience. So we try to distribute as many private poems as possible before, you know, the house lights go down. And then there's a welcome, which she explains very clearly. This is the proto space from which all other spaces and places are born. And then the word splice is stuck in there, just afloat. And then the whole thing after that is like little vignettes of dances that do and don't coincide in the images they produce with little vignettes of texts that we recite, that we've collectively written and collectively edited into little scenes describing these worlds that are sometimes a little bit dystopic, futuristic, eco-feminist, whatever. Sometimes, you know, there's like weird weather events or planets drying up or radioactive trees and whatever. So yeah, it's psychedelic.
Yes,
I hope.
Yes,
and then it's also just a lot of dancing. Like we make shapes together and stuff. Yeah, and then it ends. we disappear in a little cloudy, fluffy. And the last line is something like, the wicked deal of the whole thing is the plastic bag that came from the moon. No, the plastic bag, no, is the house that came in the plastic bag from the moon, to accept that time is not a physical or a visual thing. That's all. That's a piece.
And you have the newspaper as well.
Oh, right. And then we have 24 pages of fake news. Newspaper. Sensual journalism, we call it. Because I was referring to science fiction, and one of the collaborators was like, "But it's not fiction. We're not doing fiction. This is happening to me. This is the reality of my dance. And then so we were joking around and called it central journalism. So yeah. Published by Coven Press, and there's all fictional biographies in the back that we gave each other actually from dancing. So all the language in there is like sort of culled and edited into article formats like classifieds, personal ads, weather reports, economics, whatever. And in the back there's a series of biographies that have been written by a process of choosing scores from our own dancing writing to perform for each other, not telling anybody what we're busy with, and then we're reading the scores as if it's the biography of somebody working at Coven Press. So like based on your dancing form, style, vibe, spacing, performance, mood, everything, we're writing biographies about this person is a great editor or this person is a whatever. Those were also collectively edited. Lots of brutal, like harsh collective editing processes. Killing darlings was definitely a everyday way of getting from a lot to something actually manageable in terms of content.
Great. It definitely had a flair of shared, like in the dancing and in the writing and in the reading, what I imagined the writing to be and the reading, it had a very particular sense of shared with all of you as the authors of whatever was unfolding. Just to say about all the works that we've seen so far, they all had loads of language. Mm. And I feel almost overwhelmed with language, and there are many questions or discussions to be had around how to use language with dance, or like what your approaches have been, or what kind of narratives have you decided to put alongside your moving or dancing or however. But I, especially after seeing your work, mm-hmm. Just literally right before, I feel overwhelmed with words. Mm-hmm. And also we went visited your lecture earlier today, Eleanor. And what also struck, or what stayed with me from the lecture was this thing that you said in the beginning, how we felt that the writing you do around dancing and the dancing you do, I mean, the writing opens the doors for the dancing, for you to get the resources or whatever, but it all felt very separate. And then in the performance they still felt very independent. So how have you negotiated the space between now? Like how have you negotiated the fact that you've once felt that they were separate? Are you trying to bring them closer, or are you happy that there are like different entities? You're talking about language as well, like the different mm-hmm. languages of dance, correct me if I'm citing you wrong, or the language of language. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the division or the shared space? Mm. And also I guess something like a similar something about your work, because it had narratives, it had stories, and it was happening at the same time as
and also
physical.
Playing with the reality, like what's
yeah.
real and what's not real.
Yeah, totally.
And everything that what you said, Elena, earlier, that something is real but it's not true.
Yes.
That's like
but really? Reality in theater, anyhow, is a mm-hmm. like a
yeah.
very mysterious
yeah.
guest.
No, yeah. yeah. So I don't know if there's a question, but I'm just wondering.
Or like put on it.
Yeah, like if you can talk about putting these things along mm-hmm. alongside. Yes.
You wanna go first?
I mean, in the beginning of my research, I was really looking for more equivalence, like trying to bring language closer to the felt sense that dancing makes, is part of my daily practice. But compositionally and choreographically, also poetically, like the compositional aspects and elements of language and what it can do, accepting that they'll never be the same is very important for me. So, I think I yearn for dancing to have more agency in the production of my realities than language a little bit. It's maybe a pushback on logocentricity, and maybe that's to do with a certain history. But that's really, I feel like that's really in my daily practice of dancing and writing and wanting to sort of like be a strong advocate for dancing being great. Because dance has this problem of being a little bit the stepchild of the arts, which is only economic. It's only because it's expensive and doesn't make any money, and it's loads of labor and money to keep doing these dances that keep disappearing, and you can't collect them and put them in a museum or build a trust with them. I mean, that's it. The only reason in colonial Western modern patriarchal capitalism the dance isn't the boss is basically economic. Other reasons, historical somatophobia and oppression of the bodily senses from our common sense-making of what's good and true historically also. But, yeah, that's not a problem for other cultures, for example. Like, the Inupiat tribe in Alaska, they have dances. Dances are the center of the ceremony from which the drummers, the music follows the dance. Whereas in a lot of classical or Western dance history, the dance follows the music. So there's this assumption. There was a short story. Laura Bolton was a musicologist working in the States, I don't know when, 20s, 40s, something like this. She had the Laura Bolton Archive. She went around North America visiting First Nations tribes, recording their music with the promise that she'd come back one day and, share these recordings when she finished her field recording. She never did. At Columbia University, there was the Laura Bolton Archive sitting for years, just like untouched. And there was one Navajo PhD student in ethnomusicology who raised a bunch of money and got a huge project going to repatriate all of this music and give it back to the tribes from whom it was recorded. And most tribes reported a sort of like interest in this music, like, whoa, oh wow, this song has changed, we don't sing it like that anymore, wow, I recognize that's my grandfather singing, whoa. And it was just kind of like joyous reunion with their past most of the time. But the Inupiat in Alaska, they basically gave it back. They're like, thanks, but we don't need this. This doesn't mean anything. Like, this trace of what happened isn't what happened. Like, it was a dance. And those drummers were following the dance, and the storytellers, they follow the dance. And the dance is the center and the synthesis of the sense that's being made in that ceremony. But cool, you have a recording. I mean, have fun with it. Like, we don't need it. It doesn't tell us anything. We don't know what happened. We can't tell. Like, it's a weird relief, like,
so what? Is this the same then that you were saying in the lecture, that you want to write or and edit a text from the state of the dancing, that the dancing comes first and then the text comes from
full circle, coming from like my frustrations with, like, you know, grant writing in order to get into the studio or whatever in the present day conditions that I am living in, that have their own histories, inheritances and values. Yeah, I am interested in dance being the center of the ritual a little more in my life, but I know that when I'm writing, that's not there's the pleasure of the text. There's a thing I can do in language that I can't do in dance also. And so instead of like wishing one was the other thing, I'm just sort of digging deeper into the specificities of those two crafts. And I'm observing there are commonalities in terms of compositional force or but they don't have to be common. They're also very different in the ways that they make sense or mean things or build relationships. Anyway, how am I dealing with it? I'm letting them be separate, and then I'm interested in how they toggle and how they can relate and speak to each other. I'm also just, the reason like sci-fi comes in now is that learning about other histories or other cultures with cosmologies that don't have these problems where dance is down here, like trying to hump the leg of another art form for validity all the time. That's a Krista Parkinson quote. I didn't make it up. She's like, dance can be found humping the leg of other art forms. Like, yeah, like go to the museum and get your visual arts cachet, even though you're underpaid, you're on a concrete floor, you're cold, like it's dirty, you don't have a dressing room. Like, fuck that. Like, Jeff Koons' puppy, you pay for that. Give me a dance floor. Like, you don't, just come to the theater. We got this. Like, anyway, or whatever, pop music, give me your audience. Yeah, so I've been also victim to many of these situations where I'm like, oh shit, here we go again. It'd be nice. I feel like dance is interesting right now with all the fetish of moving image and a lot of screens, and dance is, it's like hot, you know, the history of cinema, it's like dance was one of the first things filmed. It was like cinema proved its validity, that you could see a person moving, it's moving, look, we made a moving picture, someone's moving. So this like interest in movement and moving image is making dance very fashionable right now. Like these terrible car commercials, I saw one recently, like someone doing a stupid like arm wave and then like touching the car and then getting in the car. I was like, I guess now, you know, you need PR, you call a choreographer, all right, give me the money, whatever.
Yeah, but, I mean, all the things you can tell with movement that you can't with words.
There's a sensuality, you know, that just says buy this car.
Yeah, they found it.
But also the history of porn films is like the first sort of like erotic film was erotic dancing.
Mm.
Because, you know, that's really erotic.
So there are instances where dance has its value, but yeah. I am curious now, why sci-fi is also like, can I just live under another roof or on another ground? Can I have other givens? Do I have to constantly name colonial, Western, modern, patriarchy, capitalism? Or can I just pretend, fuck you? Can I please inherit another truth or make one? Or let's take apprenticeship with other cultures that maybe did it better and don't have this problem where dance doesn't have to be a lesser form.
I have another question relating to this. I want to hear still, Matt, what, like, about this unclear question I did about bringing this language and dancing into interaction with each other. But I was wondering, because in the lecture you said earlier, I'm sorry, referencing the lecture the whole time, but you will get it now again if you weren't there, that you wanted to make choreography with light touch.
Hmm.
And I was wondering, what are the commonalities then that the people need to have in order for it to become that piece? Because it felt that there was so much shared history, at least imagined from my part, that choreography made with light touch could bring about such a specific environment or such a specific piece that everyone agrees to work with in this way.
I think I chose to work with a group of people that mostly didn't know each other and I hadn't really worked with before, but who I had met in situations where they had expressed interest or I had noticed they had some research in their work that was common with mine. So I was interested in preserving the difference of interpretation, also the very different training or history that each of these bodies carries is positive content for me. When I speak about the simplicity of a container of choreography to support the complexity of dance, that's not only for the individual dancer's complex experience to interpret and reinterpret a score that might be very simple but sort of generates constant friction and problems to solve, but that's also for each individual performer to maintain their complexity and difference. So it's interesting that there's a lot of common agreements there, but one thing I like about using language is that it generates productive misunderstanding.
Yes,
so there's a lot of like skin faster than mine imitation, like it's very quick that a culture builds in a room and we start doing things the same way, and that's just going to happen. I'm not going to try to prevent that from happening. But in order to maintain the difference of interpretation, like the way a word enters someone's mind and finds a form is always going to be very subjective and individual and based on what relationship they have to that word or whatever. So that by not working with imitation as the primary force of how we get together, having a weird poetic few lines to keep juggling or reinterpreting or rubbing up against and trying to embody, for me is about, I am constantly entertained also by how people keep solving the problem and how they solve it differently. So, yeah. The simplicity for me is, the simplicity-complexity ratio is also about the not common, the continual like invitation to check it out, make it up again, fuck it up, be seen in the process of trying, and to have an interpretation that's totally different from someone next to you, and that's, it's okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also have certain, we've discussed and agreed on certain things.
Yeah, because I, yeah.
So the I do try to deal, in the piece, I'm trying to deal with the convergence and divergence of the sense the text you're hearing and what you're seeing is making, but also divergence and convergence of our agreements about what the interpretation of the score is. So some sections are really more common in our the forms we're making or whatever. Oh, shut me up.
Yes, go for it.
What's going on?
Mark, tell us, how do you sort of like work with text and movement and text and dance?
Well, well, actually, I don't separate them so much, to be honest. Because for me, the text really, the way how I work with text is pretty much that it becomes the text through performing it. It's, you need my body there to perform the text. When you read the text, for instance, I'm working with, it doesn't make sense. I mean, maybe not in this most recent piece, but in generally. Because I'm really trying to, you know, to connect it with this actual, oh, what is the word in English? The making it. And that's why I also work a lot with very trivial text, really basic, banal text. The dialogues we know which have no value, and I hope that this value comes there in this, you know, in this space. And movement, the same way, very simple movements. That's why I'm also so keen in repetition, because it's in a way banal, rather banal thing to handle. And so, yeah, for instance, I've asked a lot, been asked by people to get give out the texts of your performances, and I'm refusing it because they are not meant to for reading. They don't work like that. You have no idea what is going on when you read it. You know, they are not rich in that sense. And you need a body to make them rich. You need the location, you need the context, you need everything. And it happens there, and the same thing, coming back to the poor old dance, which exists only for a moment, and then we all forget about it. It's the nice thing about it, that it's there. Together with me, I mean, I'm becoming pathetic again.
Don't worry.
No. Yeah, but no, I'm not actually. But but there is a charm, and there is, you know, the most simple words, as you also put it. You know, the simplicity, in a way, can be the most complex thing ever. And trigger, we all know that, of course, but trigger very beautiful things. And for me, especially when working with the audience, I want to present them a body that is rather rough and simple. The reality of performing it that is rather rough and simple and maybe not at all according to the culture of the contemporary dance performance or contemporary performance. You know, the dramaturgy is a bit like here and there, and there are moments which maybe can be considered as failures from the dramaturgical point of view. But they are necessary for me to keep a certain reality coming to that. That, you know, as an audience, you are constantly questioned. You are kind of kept alert by the performance of it, in a very sense that was this meant to be like that. And I like storytelling. And I think storytelling is a very present thing, you know. Reading is one thing, another thing, but telling a story is either through movement or, you know, like dance, so to say, or combining them is a very ancient thing. You know, the verbal, oral, you know, passing it on, or visual thing, you know, how we all know that somebody dance and I start to mimic it. So, but it needs the, I think the point of making performance art for me is really that it happens there. It's so old-fashioned way, but it is the charm of it, and that's the only the reason, for me, the only reason why to be busy with it, more or less, that something happens there. And if I tell a story, how trivial it might sound, but if the body is there and my presence is there and the presence of the audience, then I'm actually happy. So, no, really, it's, I mean, it's not whatever I do there. Of course, there are intentions behind, but I really, more and more, I'm going into this analog world. I think this is the great thing, you know, like, especially when we think of all of a sudden the presence has become a biggest value, you know, to be present somewhere, because we are not present anywhere. Like in the lecture, we are on the Facebook, you know, like attending all the events we never attend. We never make it. We are kind of in between constantly. And in theater, you actually can, you know, wall the people in that space. They are there. They have to be, and you know, they are looked bad at when you are taking, you know, the neighbor will, you know, bring you back to your. So I want to take advantage out of this situation, and I think it's maybe one of the few, now of course I'm exaggerating, but one of the few analog situations left in this world, and I like that. Did I answer anything? No.
Do you know the essay by Walter Benjamin,
yeah.
The storyteller?
Yeah. You know? Storyteller, no.
Storyteller.
I thought you were going to photography and looking. No.
You were thinking of the one with the aura of the something Asian mechanical reproduction. I'm thinking of the storyteller.
Storyteller, no.
Walter Benjamin writes an essay called The Storyteller, where he talks about the importance of the storyteller dying with the birth of printed matter and the novel.
I know that story.
And it's for sure not because he hates publishing, he's a writer.
It's
about the storyteller and the importance of that person with their bodies being
present
with the people they're telling the story to, bringing the news, bringing everything you need to know, keeping the histories alive, that embodiment of,
you know. I just to carry on with the same one, when something is dead and something bring it's like there is, this will be a long introduction now. The Bronte, Emil Bronte, what is 13 Guides, I think, in English, the title of the brother of Emil Bronte, coming from a very rich family, was kind of a loser. He tried one.
As rich boys tend to be.
this and that, and couldn't find really his, you know, agenda, so to say. And finally, he found this thing when you carve out the profiles, which was done in old time. I don't know. What you call
paper
it.
Cutting.
Paper cutting, basically, but you know, these very fine ones. And he thought that this is now it, and then photography came. And he kind of lost it. And he was, well, it's a joke, but it's actually like that, I like to keep my body in action, if I can summarize that, and keep going. But there was something else, but now I forgot. Oh, it comes back. Sorry.
There's another, like, historical connection between storytelling and bodily movement, which is that, I mean, as I heard it, it's passed down to me in ancient lore. In ancient Greece, the rhapsode who would, you know, tell the stories and that, would be there entertaining, basically telling stories to people while they were doing stuff with their hands, like shelling beans or weaving or whatever. I don't know, whittling. What do they do with their hands? Doing stuff with their hands. So that listening and sort of, touching things and moving. The story was always accompanied by a physical activity that was.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's something I just thought of in terms of embodiment and story and just random factoid.
No, but I think because what we are accused of, like, it's, we go maybe too far, but at least in Estonia, they say that in politicians, why we have such a lousy politicians is because they are not good storytellers. And why they are not good storytellers because they don't read anymore. And it was the former Prime Minister of Estonia, head of Reform Party, who said into in an interview to my friend, who does this kind of interviews, that he kind of admitted that, yes, I brought up the whole generation of new, freshly bureaucrats, politicians, technocrats. And yes, I helped them, and one of them was our next prime minister. And the thing I did wrong is that I didn't tell them how important it is to read. Of course, they read books, but they read, you know, how to become more successful and so on, you know, things like that. And, you know, even I think it was Adam Curtis or whoever mentioned it, that this, you know, we don't have any more this kind of old school Winston Churchill like storytellers ahead, and this is why they don't have an authority anymore. This is the main thing. So, not to go into that, overemphasize the importance of it, but I think there's something to think of. There's another thing I want to say, and it's maybe totally irrelevant, but I coming from Estonia, and Estonia is super e-country. We do everything online. Everything online, really. You can do whatever. You can't only buy a house online, you can't get married online, and there was something else you can't do. But you can vote, you can declare your taxes, everything can do online. You have the, and it's super comfortable. But all of a sudden, something came out, which, and this is very recent lesson we are learning right now, that people lost the contact to the government. Because it's very good system in terms of there's no corruption, there's no, you know, bureaucracy. You can do everything from home, and really to declare my taxes, it takes for me 5 minutes. I don't have to queue somewhere. But all of a sudden it appeared that to have that person in front of you, representative of the state, is actually so important to have some kind of connection. So the physical body is needed in terms of the state. And this was something, you know, we now start to learn to deal with, you know, the communication online. Well, yeah, this was really like, there was survey made in one of the counties in Estonia that why people don't attend to election, they don't go to vote, why? And they said that, why? What for? There's nobody, you know, like, there's no connection to that state. The post office is closed, the library basically is closed, everything is closed. You can order the books and this kind of the services are there, but there's not the human touch. And it's interesting.
This also makes me think of a news article that I read recently that was saying about that how reading fiction develops your empathy skills. And as well, like watching dance, probably by now years of my life, definitely I connect to dancing through physical empathy. So it just occurs to me now that both of these things enable empathy in their ways, but then I still get somehow torn between the two when they are there together for me to take in. But yeah, I mean, I wish I would have seen your shows after having this thought.
But there's this the power of storytelling is, I think, is extremely interesting, like 2019, because in journalism there is always this basic rule that beware of the narrative that sounds too good because it's not true, and also that like writing journalists said that don't write stories because people always believe them, because and facts are boring, facts are not a narrative like way of sharing information, so people always believe the story, so you have to like be really careful, and that's I think really interesting that.
And the theater is a good example of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I tell the stories which are totally untrue. But there is this expectation. Well, you are me as well. I want to sympathize. I empathize with you. I want to sympathize with you. I want to, you know, I feel for you. I'm there. And I want to take it as a truth. And I think this is also very interesting territory to play with And yet again, is it then wrong or is it not true? You know, this is also another question. I mean, if well, when I told to my friend, or kind of also a theater person, what I'm about to do, and then she told me that that, well, I have a good story about memory and remembrance mm-hmm. To tell to you. There is one incident in my life which is very dear to me. From long time ago, something happened. A memory that I carry with me is kind of it's part of my identity. I didn't ask what kind of, I understood that it's some kind of a romantic thing. And you know, just a few weeks ago I met the person who is involved, and this is this classic thing, in this memory, and he told me, well, come on, it was not at all like this. And then Laura, my friend, she told me that, well, I had remembered it wrong for 20 years, carried it with me, you know, like re-remembering, reworking it. And then again, I thought, that, and now he comes and tells me that this is all wrong.
Maybe he remembered it wrong.
And what she told me after that was that, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, I keep my memory. Mm. That's how it was. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise I lose totally my composure, you know, like my thing. This was, I keep my memory. So it's not wrong. It's the decision.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, well, yeah. In your show you told the three versions of the story who walked in a particular way, and the first one is totally true for me, and the rest, like, they were lies, obviously, but the first one was true. Like the yo-yo guy, that, like, this remained.
But it was true, actually.
So I just spotted it.
But the rest were also.
A good trick.
The ballet dancer, it's me.
Well,
no, I'm fooling with you, I'm sorry.
No, but it was very interesting to realize that, like, yes, the story, like, people want to believe the stories, yeah. And people especially want to believe the first story they hear, or that first impression is so strong. Mm. Mm.
No, but this is obvious. I mean, also this is something I like to work with, to give you the, like, well, to tease you. Mm. And then to make it clear that you shouldn't believe everything I'm saying. You know, like, this is, drop your guard.
Yeah. It's, again, another potentially unclear question coming. I was wondering, what does the fact that your work is a performance do to it? Because I had a sense in Eleanor's work that it's a practice that I could very much enjoy doing myself. And as a practice, it can be, doing the practice can already, just doing the practice is already a lot and it's a thing. And then with you, I was wondering that, yeah, I could have a similar experience potentially if we went for a coffee. Mm. Or we, like, that you were so good at fooling me in not keeping my guards up, even if that's what you wanted to suggest now. I was wondering what does the performance do to these practices, or I don't know if this is a relevant question at all, it came to me.
Well, for me, it's all about the performance, to be honest. It's really, this is the context where I realize it. And, well, we of course can go to the coffee, and probably wouldn't be so different, but, I mean, all the, you know, the premise is set by the thing that it's, and this is what I'm dealing with, pretty much. So I can't go by it, even though I pretend maybe, or try to, and that's, I wouldn't lie to you at the coffee, you know. I wouldn't use that, because I also think that you might think of it as a performance, and probably do, you know. And also the way I move, or the physicality, I mean, there, which I am very physical, you see me exhausting, which is actually quite real thing. There's nothing like faked, so to say, that to put these things together on stage, a certain things which probably you have no doubt that this is happening right now, and the other which is a bit like, you know, blurry where it comes from and if this is real. So this is for me possible only in stage, and for exactly this reason it's interesting that, you know, to create a certain empathy among the people to interpret things differently, and you know, to yeah, not take it granted, you know, like black and white. Oh, I was not happy with this, but you know.
What does the performing do to the practice? It gives, yeah, it, kind it gives of. It a front.
Yeah.
For better or worse. Yeah. I think there's other pieces I've made where the resonance with the audience is more important in terms of what happens. And I really like, I'm reading and surfing the vibe of the room. But this performance is quite like, you know, it's going to be pretty much as it is whether or not you're watching.
Yeah.
But that's also the nature of working in a group, I think. Like, we are each other's audience so much. But yeah, I pull out my chops when I'm on stage. There's nothing like attention to heighten my attention. You know, when I'm my own audience, I have like slumps and drops and criticism and confusion and curiosity, but then something happens and then sometimes it's super magic, but then it disappears. And there's a very different quality of how I perform for my own attention. Yeah, but there's a certain accountability when there's 200 people watching, where I know that my attention is the only thing, goddamn it, holding this together in a way. You know, like I know that my attention is inviting you to attend to what's happening in a specific way. So it's just sharpened. That's also just performance. That's like adrenaline that's any athlete would describe, like time passing faster when in a game than in practice or whatever. There's something about showtime which makes the attending more acute. And then I pull myself up to the challenge, you know, like I enjoy, like, well, no, I don't let myself off the hook. There's not a microsecond where I'm not completely crafting my attention and my movement.
Is it then a practice that, in the lack of a better word at the moment, it develops through the performing, or is the performing something that just happens at particular moments in the research and maybe takes it somewhere or shifts the focus or however, but is the performing a way to develop it or create it, or is it just something that is part of the medium?
In the process of being in like a 5-year research where I'm really dealing with like one question unfolding and trying to stay at the front of that question, I consider the performing like a publishing practice. Like, where I am with my questions, what I've understood is what I'm sharing, but also the current edge of what I'm not sure about yet. Like, that's where I'm trying to be in the composing of what to do and in the doing. That's unique. That's not the same as a piece that I would pretty much not change and perform the same way for 2 years, but enjoy maybe the each iteration specificity because this audience was like this or this day was like that. The whole piece itself is changing according to the time and place because I'm also considering it a kind of publishing of research somehow. Is that an answer?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, from my perspective, it seemed to, it seemed that I can witness a process of something rather than that, like the heightened end result of something. I don't know what's the difference though, but still, it felt like an ongoing, like it had happened before and it will happen after as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm watching the time. We still have time.
I have one more question from the lecture. Mm. You were saying about
so many things. It was 2 hours.
I know, so many things. So many words. Like in these past, I don't know, 24 hours, I've encountered so many words. This thing of when you were saying that you felt like you were done with dancing, because you had, again, I might be quoting you wrong, correct me later, you were done with dancing because you were done with what you had allowed yourself to do in the dancing. Mm. So do you feel like you also had to, when you started working with all of the spectrum of the muddy and bind, like do you feel like you also had to introduce it to the audience in a different way? Mm. Or like how to welcome the audience to watch the muddy and bind instead of the body and mind?
Mm. Yeah, I think I've always been, I've always had a lot of pleasure in performing. But mostly I think in the past I separated, as a performer, it was a different separation thing than as a dancer. But as a performer, I had been separating my sort of like penchant for entertainment from my dancing skills. And there was also in there, I think language played a role, that language belonged to this sort of a direct address, telling stories, making jokes, monologues, songs, cha-cha-cha, no business, like show business, like these very sort of like frontal, fast and easy agreements with an audience. And that dancing was this weird other remote thing that's full of nonsense and a lot of skill that nobody understands. And that separation, I think, wasn't serving me, but I hadn't found how to bring them together necessarily. There was like maybe one solo a long time ago where I was called Big Girls Do Big Things, where I think I kind of worked them together a little more. But that was also a very personal endeavor. I was really dealing with my own image as a performer and as a person in the world, so that of course they were synthesized because I was the one making sense of them. So in a shared project, I think it was very rare that I managed to bring those sensibilities together. So there's one project, I think, when I was like doing this weird kind of like rock musical thing, that I was aiming for a really like inclusive, like all hands on deck, all ways of making sense included. Yeah, there I think I was going for that more holistic approach. But the moment where I got, like, I decided I didn't have to be a good dancer anymore was the moment also where I could release judgment on this skilled thing that nobody understands and sort of let it flood in a way, like let it be gnarly or let it be messy and let it be disobedient and let it be funky and let it be horny and let it be loud and let it be funny and let it be dry and let it be tired and let it be sloppy and let it be heavy and then all the other like the more like conventional values of dancing. They were more available all of a sudden. It was like the palate broadened, and therefore like all the pointy toes and all the muscularity and all the jump and all the swerve and all the style and finesse, I go, wow, like it came up like in full res, like ready to go to complete all this other whatever this mess could be that wasn't available. So that's a way that somehow the dance, yeah, they're related. But I feel like I had to come at them from the angle of like the pieces I'm making and what I'm presenting on stage, the practice in the room, like what am I allowing myself. So it's been like it's been a process of undoing sort of boundaries between what I'm considering dance or non-dance or what belongs together. And that was also from different cultural encounters. I think coming from the States, like entertainment was like a given. It was in my blood. Like it was like, it was a language I spoke. And it, there was a certain like wit and humor and craft and like jive that was in the pieces that were being made when I left New York in 2003. And that was like foreign language in Europe. I showed up here and all of a sudden it was like, what? No. I would constantly get this question like, are you being ironic? I'm like, what? What's irony again?
There's that song by Alanis Morissette, but what do you mean ironic exactly? Like, yeah, can I be serious and funny? Because I think the only way to handle something really grave is to find the humor in it, or it's not funny if it's not really actually important. So humor and gravity for me are like, they hang out all the time, but they had to be thrown apart, sent to their rooms for 4 years, whatever, however long I was getting schooled in what's a concept and what's an art. Fuck. And all of a sudden, like, all this, like, history of abstraction was, like, loud and heavy and hard, and I was in Belgium where you make shapes, and you don't look at the audience, you look at the floor, and you let yourself be seen in your shapes, yourself serious shapes. And I was like, I made shapes before, but they didn't feel like this. Like, I had work to do after parts, just if you will. Yeah, and many years. It was great. I learned stuff. I hung out with theory. There was all sorts of things that opened up for me. Also about directing and collaborating that I didn't, you know, it was very intuitive. In New York, you're just like, hey guys, you want to make a dance? Cool, I don't have any money. I'll pay you from my pocket. And then you're like, yes, I want to make your dreams come true. What do we do? 5, 6, 7, 8? And you don't have time for like asking questions, creating problems, practices, research, whatever wasn't there. So there's a lot of stuff that I gained, but I felt like there was. Took some years afterwards to figure out what I'd lost and invite it to the party. And then it's been interesting in the frame of a PhD research to sort of understand what are the like older historical canons that are producing these givens or these values, and then choosing, as I said before, like to be able to say like, okay, well maybe I don't accept that given. That has informed this agreement here culturally, but what if the dance is the boss of the story and the drumming, whatever. So it's a journey. Still on it. To let you know how it goes.
Yeah, great. Looking forward to hearing the end result when you're done.
Mm. But Mark, tell me, you told us that you had a sort of like a period of time that you did something else than dance, and then now you decided to sort of come back. What happened?
Kind of, actually, not that I thought of like this, that I do something else. I started to work with text more, and then somehow the theaters discovered me and they invited me to do commissioned work, and this I did. But I thought that I was really choreographing the words. Mm-hmm. This was my idea of it, you know, even though the actors, I mean, I used all their bodies and really the postures, everything. It was very refined how they, and probably also for them very surprising that this can be seen as a choreography. So for me, it wasn't actually time away, but for the majority of the people, it was. And actually, it was surprising for me to find it, that they didn't see what I'm busy with. You know, how I work with space. Juha, who came to see the performance, when I made Talk to Me here in Pannuhalli, he told me that, well, you are a choreographer, you are not a director, you know, because how you work with the situation. So, it was like that. So, not that I'm thinking of it like that, you know, I'm not really actually thinking of categories, but it's. But I would say, yes, I try to choreograph. Choreograph? Text. Choreograph text. That is what I do. But there might be no text, too, so, but... Maybe it's a bit relief, I don't know, sometimes, how I work, maybe.
Relief?
Relief? What is it called?
A surface pulled off the...
Well, I think maybe it's not the right term then.
I love that word, so I hope it's the word you mean.
No, it's when something is too obvious, you know, like it's coming, but it comes together for me with banality, you know, because I love banal things, and when I was listening to your American entertainment things, that also, well, maybe it's something different. I guess it's something different, but the banal things, they can be very beautiful when you really insist on them. And actually quite serious stuff is there, because we are banal by nature, I think, often, as we are poetic and romantic and whatever. But
yes, very recognizable and relatable. Were you working, when you were working more in theatre environments, were you working on like classic texts, or were you making your own work from scratch?
No, this I can't really relate to be honest. I'm sorry. Maybe this is the most poetic text in this piece I'm using now I ever worked with. It's really basically the dialogue we record and, you know, talk, there are topics, and then I start to work with this text.
So with the actors, it's devised?
Not always, but yeah. There was the same No 99 theater. I made a production for them, and basically the production, it was called Fantastica. Fantastica is an Estonian word, but it kind of means fantastic, but there is a slightly different game. And basically what I did as a performance was a post-performance discussion. So there was a moderator, and the company was sitting there in the first row, and 2 hours we were talking. But I choreographed it all, you know, it was all set, and they learned to lie so well that people really in the audience thought that this is, you know, authentic.
But that they missed the show and just got there in time for the after talk.
No, but actually this was the thing, we kind of made it, you know, we flipped it. Later on we opened the gates and we went to the stage, and we started to do the same, but because we went on stage, the same monologues became something else. Mm. But the thing was that we really, actually, we started late. We were waiting and waiting and waiting to start because one actor was missing. And then we lied as hell why he was missing, and everybody bought it because, as I said, the audience is...
wants to believe stories.
Wants to believe stories, but things like that. And, yeah.
Just to say...
Got sidetracked.
No, yeah, we are here to talk about your work, so...
Sidetracks are
I thought about your politics now.
Well, it's all the same. Just to say, we've been speaking for more than an hour, and I don't want to keep you all night. So, if we have something burning we still want to say on record, let's do it. And if not, we can just like...
Thanks for having us.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And have a great show tomorrow.
Oh, thank you.
And have a great trip back home, I suppose.